Good afternoon. I'm Chief Judge Bonnie Bulla of the Nevada Court of Appeals, and with me are my colleagues today, Judge Michael Gibbons and Judge Deborah Westbrook. This is the date and time set for oral argument in case number 86816, consolidated with case number 87710, in the matter of In Re Guardianship of MJV. At the council table, I believe we have, Gabriel, oh, you're for respondents, though, correct?
No.
So,
no. Seems like the tables are switched. Usually,
the tables are switched.
The other side.
What happened? Okay. Well, that won't help.
Name tags are right.
The name tags are correct. It's just usually that's the appellate spot.
Okay. So let's try this again.
Yes.
At council table, we have, Gabriel Blumberg for the appellant, Kelly Varden, and then we have Arlette Newvine for respondents, Randy Burns and Brenda Meservi-Bala. Is anyone else with you at council table?
Yes, Your Honor. Michael Pettis.
Hello. All right. Each party is limited to 15 minutes of argument. Mr. Blumberg, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
3 minutes.
We are ready to proceed. The podium is yours.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Gabriel Blumberg, along with Michael Fetter, is pro bono counsel on behalf of appellant Kelly Varden. District court can abuse its discretion in two different ways, either by disregarding controlling law or making factual findings that lack substantial evidence. Here, we have both errors that the district court committed warranting reversal of that court's order. First, the district court disregarded controlling law by failing to consider the recommendations of the guardian ad litem and the court-appointed special advocate as required by NRS 159.061 subsection 6. That section of the statute clearly provides that the court shall give consideration to any recommendation made by a guardian ad litem or court-appointed special court advocate. Here, the record reflects that consideration was not given by the district court. And it's important here because the two recommendations given were completely contrary to the result the district court ultimately reached in this matter. So the guardian ad litem here was, his name was Dave Neely. He had been the guardian ad litem for 5 years for a minor who had just been a little bit over the age of five at the time of the subject hearings. So he had known the minor for her entire life. He was in the best position to make a recommendation to the court regarding what was in that minor's best interest, using his experience and the number of visits he had with both the minor and both appellant and respondent in this case. Relying on that experience and what he had heard at the trial and the evidentiary hearing, he informed the district court, it was his recommendation initially that it should be a 50-50 split. But then after hearing the allegations against Mr. Burns, which everybody at the hearing said they had concerns about given the alleged misconduct with the subject minor, the court appointed guardian ad litem Neely said, I believe that sole custody should be granted to Ms. Varden.
Mr. Blumberg, in order to comply with NRS 159A0616E, was the district court required to adopt the recommendations of the guardian ad litem and ACORN representative, or was the court merely required to consider their recommendations?
The statute does say consider. However, I think it's important here because when you have recommendations that go completely contrary to the ultimate decision, I think you need the district court judge to give some reasoning as to why he totally disregarded those opinions, which here there's nothing in the record saying that. Nothing at the hearing, at the end of the hearing saying, I'm aware that Mr. Neely and Ms. McKenna suggested otherwise, but this is my ruling. Nothing in the written order explaining I considered these opinions, but I'm going the other way because of this. And it's a real problem in this case because we believe the substantial evidence in this case aligns exactly with Mr. Neely and Ms. McKenna's recommendations, and that he couldn't have reached this decision had he actually given consideration to Mr. Neely and Ms. McKenna's recommendations.
Mr. Blumberg, does the fact that the respondents were vetted to be foster parents at least act as an equalizer to the other agency's recommendations? And wouldn't the district court be in the best position to evaluate their testimony?
I think that goes to suitability, Your Honor, and I think it would suggest that she's suitable, but the analysis the court was required to make here is who is more suitable. So the mere fact that they passed that initial vetting and said, okay, you're suitable to be guardians or foster parents, that doesn't necessarily mean they're more suitable than my client, Ms. Harding, who the evidence showed should have been awarded custody and guardianship.
So, Mr. Blumberg, back to the question from Judge Westbrook. The statute says consider the recommendation. So when does it change from consider to must follow? If the evidence is at a certain level, are you saying the court must follow the recommendation?
No, Your Honor, and I agree with Your Honor, that's not the language, but you need some indication that that consideration actually occurred, which we do not have in this case.
The judge did make comments about it. I mean, the judge worked with these people too. I mean, these are court programs, and the court's going to give consideration. It looks like the court did here. It just disagreed.
Obviously, the ultimate conclusion this court reached was in disagreement, but the problem we have here is there's no direct line or any line explaining why that disagreement occurred, and it's simply disagreement that doesn't make sense given the facts and the evidence adduced.
Okay.
The evidence
so are, let's say you're right. The court didn't consider it. Is the court required to make special findings because of this statute regarding this is what was said, this is, I understood it, I considered it, but I disagree? Does the court have to be that explicit? And if it does, what's the authority for that?
I think the court should be making those findings. Admittedly, the statute doesn't contain that exact language that Your Honor cited, but the problem we run into is in situations like this, where you have two clear recommendations in favor of the appellant, and the district court veers away from them, especially after the district court in the hearing said, I'm leaning towards awarding Barden custody and guardianship, which would have aligned with that, and then suddenly makes a U-turn. There should be some explanation as to why, especially so this court can have some sort of meaningful appellate review.
Would an explanation include the court evaluating the best interest factors and looking at it in terms of what guardianship would be in the best interest of the minor?
Yes, Your Honor, because that's another requirement for the district court here, in that they need to look at the best interest factors, and we think the errors in the district court's analysis of those factors compounded the issues of not adopting the recommendations of either Mr. Neely or Ms. McKenna here.
Can you explain to us what errors you believe the district court made in its evaluation of the best interest factors?
Sure. So
let me stop you there. We'll come right back to that. But you said the court must do it. As I'm looking at Chapter 159A, it talks about certain factors the court must consider under the minor guardianship statute. Then it can consider other relevant factors or information. So isn't the 125C factors only the extra information that the court can look at, and it's not required to look at it, specifically the best interest factors from the child custody statute?
I think the court is required to look at those best interest factors because, admittedly, the ultimate guiding force here is the best interest of the child. But what we have here is...
I'm talking about the statute. What does the statute say? You have 159A, says this is what you have to do, and then it has more of a catch-all provision that you can look at other things too.
That's correct, Your Honor. And so,
but it doesn't say you have to do 125C. The Nevada Supreme Court hasn't said that. It says you can, but I don't know that it says you have to. Right, let's switch gears back to Judge Bola's question. The court did look at it. It just didn't call it that, but the court used factors. So back to her question about the best interest factors and the evidence.
Well, before I go back to Your Honor's question, I do want to hit on that best interest question because the statute 125C.0035 relates to the best interest of the child in custody determinations. And it says, in any action for determination of physical custody of a minor child, the sole consideration of the court is the best interest of the child. So I think the court here does have to go through those factors because it was both a custody and a guardianship determination that was made.
If the case was brought under 125C, which is possible, but it's under 159A.
Well, it is under 159A because the primary thing that started the case was a petition for guardianship, but the court then expands its determination to do guardianship and custody.
So where do you think the court was mistaken on the application of the best interest factors, even though I agree it didn't call it that, but that's what it seemed to be when the court was making its findings?
Yes, Your Honor. So if we go through the court's order, I think it does attempt to track these factors in subsection 4 of the statute, where the court is required to shall consider once again certain factors. And we think there's three certain factors here that the court made errors on. One is which parent is more likely to allow the child to have frequent associations and continuing relationships with the non-custodial parent. Two is the mental and physical health of the parents. And three is the physical and developmental emotional needs of the child. So as for the first factor, which parent is more likely to allow a frequent association, continuing relationship with the other parent? I think the evidence here was clear that that factor should have favored Barty. The evidence in the record, including Ms. Maservi Vallis' testimony herself, said she cuts off communications with others when she feels they're being passive aggressive. She made no efforts to coordinate care or reach out to Ms. Barden at all concerning the relationship with the child. In contrast, you had testimony in the record demonstrating Ms. Barden did the exact opposite. She would text updates to Ms. Maservi Vallis. She'd say, hey, there's school pictures, there's an Easter event, we're doing these things, we want you to be involved in the child's life. Despite that evidence, the court came to the contrary conclusion that somehow Ms. Maservi Vallis was better, more important, or more likely to facilitate a relationship with the opposing petitioner. And that simply can't be the case here. And it's important here because the district court highlighted the fact that this was a major concern for the court. And if it's a major concern for the district court, it's important that it would have got this analysis right. And the evidence simply isn't there to support the district court's decision on that factor.
Is there anything that you can point to in the record that would tell us what type of visitation Ms. Barden envisioned for the respondents in this case? What type of visitation did Ms. Barden anticipate would occur if she were the guardian?
So I think there's two parts to that, Your Honor. The first part is the options were either she got primary custody and guardianship, which would have had visitation awarded to Ms. Maservi Vallis, which is sort of the converse of the order that was entered, or it would have been split 50-50. We think the evidence here clearly indicated that she should have been awarded the primary custody and guardianship with visitation to Ms. Maservi Vallis. So it would have been either weekends or every other weekend custody or visitation to Ms. Maservi Vallis, with the caveat here on Mr. Burns that it would have to be supervised given the concerns about the allegations made regarding him.
So currently the parties do not have 50-50 split custody or guardianship, correct?
Correct. The order did not award 50-50.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Blumberg, you started off saying there were four. The court, you disagree with the rulings of the court on three of them. Okay. So in the big picture, you just tried to explain on the first one why you think that was really important. Do you have to show errors on all three of them? I mean, there's multiple factors and there's no requirement that the court give more weight to one than the other. So if the court was correct on one of them, you're not challenging that particular one. Is that a reason standing alone to rule in favor of the respondent here, Ms. Maservi Vallis? And that was the factor dealing with the better living conditions.
Right. And I focused on the three because, candidly, Your Honor, the other ones I don't think factored either way. Ability to meet the needs of the child, the district court found that in favor of both of them. There was real no dispute regarding the ability, the history of parental abuse or neglect, or whether anybody has engaged in domestic violence. Those weren't at issue. So the three I focused on in the briefing
right,
you mentioned.
Right. I'm saying what, I mean, normally we defer to the factual findings of the district court. So how bad of a mistake does this have to be to overturn the decision of the district court? I mean, we see this in custody cases all the time. There's 12 factors, some apply, some don't. The court found several in favor of one party, maybe one or more in the other party. and it has to balance them and make a call. So how does this outweigh what the court found on the other factors, and in particular the one you're not challenging?
Because I think the ultimate analysis here ends up with three factors in favor of my client and one against. And I think
does that mean the court has to rule in favor of your client if it's 3-1?
I think the court needs to make an explanation if it's going to determine that simply having a better housing situation is determining factor, that somehow outweighs the developmental, physical, and emotional needs of the child, or the ability to foster a relationship with the opposing party.
What if there's conflicting evidence on some of these?
I think the evidence here was clear in favor of Ms. Varden.
It's extremely rare where a case is all the evidence is on one side and the court rules the other way. It's almost always people are fighting over it and there's a different views of that same evidence. It's not like you're deciding, is it black, is it white? These are all judgment calls.
There are judgment calls, but that's where the statutes come into play, Your Honor. And I think that harkens back to the 159 analysis, where the legislature tells the court, you have to give consideration to these specific recommendations. And if we end up with a ruling that's contrary to those and contrary to the findings and factors in 125C, I think there has to be some sort of explanation for the district court of how did we end up at this bizarre result.
I'm sorry, I was using up your time you wanted to say for a rebuttal.
I'll reserve the remaining time.
We'll see how it goes.
Sorry about that.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Arlette Neuvine, bar number 14613 of Neuvine Law, on behalf of Brenda Meservi-Bala and Randy Burns, the respondents. With me today is Ms. Brenda, as well as bio mom of the minor child, MJV, who is currently 7 years old, almost eight, was 5 years old at the time of the proceedings. I wanted to touch on a couple of questions that were asked, specifically that Kelly, during her testimony, admitted, which is found on Bates stamp 303, appellant volume 2, 303, that navigating sharing time with MJV with respondents would be difficult for her. She very specifically said that, Your Honor. That if there are factual disputes, that this court is not going to disturb the district court's ruling absent an abuse of discretion. That if there's conflicting evidence, we know that the trial judge is in the best position possible to determine credibility and to resolve these disputes. While appellants rely heavily on the Kathy McKenna was CASA, now ACORN, I think the reasoning behind Kathy's suggestion that Varden would be better is telling as to why the district court didn't take that stance. Kathy, when on stand, was asked by me, give me some pros and cons of placing the child with my client Brenda. And in response, the only negative thing she had to say was about Brenda is that the child had anxiety or wasn't as social, I believe was the word she used, a five-year-old. And so when asked about pros about my client, she explained that my client has had the child since birth, so for 5 years at the time, that my client had a big yard and things to go out and play and plant seeds, I believe was her language, that they had time for her. Additionally, my client was in the process of becoming a licensed foster parent for the minor or for the child in question, for her little brother, that she had a very good relationship with the minor child's half sibling who was with a different grandmother, that they spent holidays and birthdays and things together. But yet, because the child wasn't social enough, Kathy, the ACORN, or CASA, suggested that Varden would be better. Additionally, we have the guardian ad litem, who had been appointed on the case for many years. In 2019, the guardian ad litem had made a suggestion in my client's favor. And then at the beginning of this hearing, he had stated 50-50, was spotty within the hearing. It states within the order that the guardian ad litem was only present for a couple days out of the 3-day trial. And then for some reason, sort of made a flop on his suggestion. And I think your honors are spot on when saying that this is a consideration and not dispositive. The thing, thankfully, right, the district court judge is in the best position possible to hear all the evidence.
Isn't it unusual, Ms. Neuwein, for the court not to follow the recommendation, particularly when there's two people here, one as a guardian ad litem, one as a CASA, specifically representing or advocating for the best interests of the child?
I would say yes, and I think it partly made me very proud walking out of the trial court. But I think it comes back to the reasoning that was given by particularly Kathy, the CASA. The only reasoning she gave in favor of Arden was this so-called social, I believe she used the word anxiety, but I'm second-guessing myself at the moment, but I know it was not as social. Whereas there was evidence that showed that the child was in fact social with her biological siblings and a cousin, and that, you know, there were several pros given about Brenda that outweighed whatever concern was given by both the guardian ad litem and Kathy. And I disagree with counsel in that the district court did make rulings that can be seen in appellant's volume 4, starting around base stamp 884, where the district court, or the Honorable Judge Lane, explains, as trained officers and attorneys, they know that for many years of experience, it takes more than just a concern. Those are the words that he uses. And he even kind of analogizes it to the, like a justice of a peace in a criminal hearing, whereas, you know, slight marginal evidence and these things, which makes sense. Judge Lane was prosecutor for many years.
Did the court explain why it did not follow the recommendations?
What I believe he stated was that it has not risen to the level where I should let the overwhelming evidence in this case be guided solely by the I'm concerned issues that were given by people.
What was the overwhelming evidence in your favor of your client?
Yes, Judge, that would be the fact that my client had the child for 5 years, that my client was treating the minor child's physical disability. The child suffered from a radial ray malformation. She had a thumb bone missing. She had spent 5 years taking the child to different specialists, in-home specialist therapy, occupational therapy, potential surgeons weighing different ideas. On the other hand, we have Kelly Varden, who lied in her initial petition for guardianship, stating that the child had lived with her whole life, which wasn't true, who lives in a senior living community that doesn't allow children, doesn't quite have a yard even, that there were no children around, that Varden suffered from fibromyalgia and a 10-plus year history of a dependent on prescription pain pills such as oxycodone, that she vapes nicotine, that the child didn't have her own bedroom in the house. Instead, they converted a den and a two-bedroom house that they were living in with with Varden's mother, that she had lied on some of her interrogatories. The willingness to facilitate a good relationship between the child and Brenda, had Varden gotten custody, the court awarded Brenda makeup time for losing out on time due to Varden's actions.
So how do these facts tie in with the best interest factors? First of all, do you agree the court had to look or did look at the best interest factors, and how did the evidence relate? Because Mr. Blumberg is essentially saying that the best interest factors strongly favored his client.
I think that when we're looking at the ruling that the judge gave from the bench around the site, the bait stamp 884, is that the judge was going through those factors. He states that which grandparents more likely to allow the child to have frequent association, continuing relationship. They both disappoint me, but I lean towards Brenda. Level of conflict between the parties is outrageous. The ability to cooperate and meet the needs of the child. I think they both love the child enough that they would cooperate for that. The physical health and mental health, I lean towards Brenda on physical health and mental health. I think that was supported again, by Barden being diagnosed with fibromyalgia and lupus and requiring the oxycodone, a 10-year dependency on oxycodone, requiring rest to make sure that to manage her pain levels. There was some mention about how Brenda was going to therapy. It was sort of frustrating for me to read that this was kind of argued in a negative light when I believe, and I believe the court believes, that that's more of a healthy way to express your feelings by going to therapy. There was no evidence to say that Brenda was going to therapy for some negative reason, but instead she was going to therapy. The court continues to weigh those factors, as you asked, when it goes on to say that the physical developmental needs of the child, court says the Bowles do fine with that, the nature of the relationship of the child with each, the ability to maintain a relationship with siblings. Obviously, I think Brenda will do better. Living conditions lean towards Brenda. Complying with doctors lead towards Brenda. I mean, he weighed these factors. And then even in the written order, and there were two orders, Your Honors. I'm going lightning fast, and I apologize if I didn't answer your question.
No, you have very limited time and a lot to cover.
Okay. There were two orders that were issued, and curiously, the first one wasn't included in appellant's brief or in his appendix. I had supplied that in my appendix. There was an initial preliminary order, notice of entry of orders stamped June 2nd of 2023, and the court sort of makes a blanket statement there that it appearing to the satisfaction of the court, that notice is sufficient, that it appearing by clear and convincing evidence that it's necessary to appoint guardian, where is it? Here. That for the reasons stated at the evidentiary hearing, which will be stated in an additional order, Brenda Mazurbi Bala is hereby appointed guardian for the minor child, and then Barden received every other weekend visitation. This, Your Honor,
by the way, is that what you asked the court to do?
Judge Lane asked counsel and I to sort of iron out some ancillary issues, such as, you know, like a holiday schedule and things, and we didn't have the time to hash that out right there. And my clients needed the guardianship order to proceed with life. Essentially, counsel and I agreed to draft this order, supply it, and then do our best to try and agree on an additional order, which I will be honest with you, I thank you guys for the opportunity to be here. I think it's made me a better lawyer, but I don't think that there's been a clear abuse of discretion. There are significant facts within this case that show that Brenda was the better candidate. And because there was no clear abuse of discretion, this court should not disturb the ruling of the Honorable Judge Lane, who again was in the best position possible to make the determinations that he did. So with that being said, I think that appellants don't meet their burden, and it's a difficult burden. This isn't an easy burden to overcome, and I don't think that they've achieved it. There's significant evidence to show that the best interest factors are supported, that the factors under the guardianship statute also support Brenda, finding that Brenda is more suitable as well. And I believe that the district court made the best decision possible.
Okay. There was a side issue. The court also ordered sole custody or sole legal custody in favor of your client. Was that something you asked for? Do you know where that came from? Because I mean, that's normally not what's said in a guardianship case.
In the rules, you know, we have a single judge for all areas, and I think that Judge Lane, being the amazing judge that he is, but a prosecutor for many years, this is outside of sort of his wheelhouse. And so when he even stated on record, he's treating it almost like a custody case because he wanted Barden to have some visitation. He even awarded her sort of what you would see in a custody order, the every other weekend. He ordered it. We wrote it in.
But even if it was sole legal custody, using that terminology, as a guardian, your client would have been able to make those legal decisions. So is it really material to the outcome?
I believe not. No, I don't believe it's material. I think that with my client being guardian, no other co-guardian assigned, that she had those powers. I think perhaps Judge Lane's mindset was just sort of in that divorce or custody type of mindset, because he wanted the child to have continuing relations with both, but he wanted to be real clear that...
I mean, the main issue with that is the medical care and the psychological care.
Correct. Yeah, of course.
So, were the two grandmothers able to agree on anything in that regard?
At that point, the relationship had significantly deteriorated. And so that's why Judge Lane, I believe, made the ruling that he did, that Brenda's going to have control over it, that he wasn't going to make them have to try to come up with an agreement, because it seemed clear that they weren't going to be able to.
Yeah. As you said, there were two orders and they were like 5 months apart.
Correct.
Did that delay cause any problem?
Well, not necessarily, because that first order gave the guardianship that was necessary. The second order was a result of counsel and I's availability, willingness to agree, and those things. It would be easier if the judge said this, and there was kind of some left up to, like the holiday visitation, for example. We had a hard time arguing something like that. Your Honor, I think that you guys have asked all the right questions, right? Like, you know, there's no clear abuse of discretion here, that the trial judge was in the best position possible. There are significant facts. In fact, Judge Lane said overwhelming evidence. Those were his words. He felt overwhelmed by the evidence in favor of Brenda, that he wasn't willing to be swayed by any other, you know, mere concerns, were his statements. Thank you.
Thank you.
I do want to touch a little bit on this overwhelming evidence comment. It was in the briefs and you heard it again today. I think it's important because the court did actually indicate it was inclined to go 50-50 at some point, and then it actually switched over to leaning in favor of Vardin. And you see that at the appendix at 688. And so by the time that decision was made, the court had already heard from every single witness except for Mr. Burns. So for the overwhelming evidence to support a contrary conclusion to where he was leaning at the point where he had heard the vast majority of evidence, just simply cannot be, especially when you have these recommendations from the guardian ad litem and the court-appointed special advocate.
Counsel, we'll go ahead and give you another minute 30 so you can complete whatever other arguments you'd like to complete.
I'd like to interject a question, though. It was stated by Mr. Neuwein that she was here for Ms. Meservey-Balla and Mr. Burns. But as I understand that order, looking at it, the court did not appoint Mr. Burns as a guardian or co-guardian, and he's not part of this case. Do you see it otherwise?
He wasn't awarded guardianship. The problem we have with the order, and that's another issue in this case, is that Mr. Burns lives with Ms. Meservey-Balla, and the key issue at the hearing was these allegations against Mr. Burns that everyone said they had concerns about. And the only enforcement mechanism the court put in that order to protect the child against Mr. Burns was Ms. Meservey-Balla herself. And that's an issue in this case because...
But Mr. Burns wasn't appointed, so he's really not part of this appeal, is he? He's not a guardian.
We're not challenging the fact that he's appointed guardian. No, he's not appointed the guardian. Right.
So your argument is about Ms. Meservey-Balla, but you say he's in the same home.
I think the evidence made that clear in the court's attempt to fashion a remedy to address the concerns about Mr. Burns was inefficient in this matter, especially where the record shows that Ms. Meservey-Balla has a history of letting her daughter back near the child, and the evidence appointing the court-appointed special advocate required Ms. Meservey-Balla to communicate with her, and we saw in the evidence that she cuts off relationships and specifically cut off the relationship with Ms. McKenna.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry I interrupted. Do you have any key point you want to make sure that we understand before you are...
Two things really quickly. One, going back to Your Honor's initial question about do we need to get to these best interest factors, I think the answer is yes, even under NRS 159A because subsection 9 does specifically say the decision should be guided by the best interest factor. So I think you then do go back to 125C.
It says guided by the best interest of the child.
Correct.
Not the best interest factors.
It must always act in the best interest of the protected minor. Correct. And then secondly, I think it is important to note that in the past couple of weeks, the Supreme Court did come out with a decision on 159A in the matter of HB the third, where it did find that it was an error not to consider all the suitability factors. And so I think when you have a case like this, where you have these recommendations, where Your Honor was correct, those recommendations usually are followed by the district court, and we have a 180 here, it should be stated somehow in the order or on the record why that turnabout happened, why those recommendations were not followed.
Ms. Neubeim went through the factors. She was reading from the transcript of the order, and she's saying the judge went right through those factors. Are you saying he didn't go through them?
I'm saying there's nothing in the record or that I heard from Ms. Neubeim today where the judge said, I hear your recommendation, Mr. Neely and Ms. McKenna. I'm not following it because X, Y, Z.
No, not that, but the best interest factors, because you said this new case says the court should apply the best interest factors. Are you saying the court did not apply them here?
Well, let me clear that up. The new case deals with 159A and the suitability factors, including under subsection 6. It's not the best interest factor.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
If I misstated that, I want to clear that up. But the court did go through those best interest factors, but that's the other argument we had, is that the substantial evidence in this case dictated that he reached the wrong conclusion on those best interest factors and should have found in favor of Barden on them.
Mr. Blumberg, what do we do with the fact that on page 3 of the court's order, October 31st, 2023 order, it said that the concerns that were raised by the guardian ad litem and the ACORN representative were not found to rise to the level of slight or marginal evidence nor probable cause, and therefore the case was closed and not provided to the district attorney's office for prosecution. I mean, those concerns were the underlying concerns that formed the basis for the GAL and the ACORN's recommendations, correct?
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. I think they impacted, but I think the transcript's actually clear that they were 50-50 before those concerns were even raised. I think they then switched fully to Varden once they heard those concerns, but I think even without them, they were 50-50.
Well, couldn't that finding be an explanation of why the district court did not follow their recommendations, to the extent those recommendations were impacted by concerns?
I don't think it is, Your Honor, because I think this part of the order addresses the elephant in the room was the allegations against Mr. Burns at the hearing. And the court had forensic interviews conducted. They went down that path. No charges were filed. Ultimately, based on that, the court decided, I still have concerns, as you can see from the fact that he put in these injunctive measures at the end of the order, but said, because it doesn't rise to the level of criminal conduct, I'm going to still award it to Brenda. But I don't think that changes or addresses the recommendations by either Mr. Neely or Ms. McKenna, no.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for